Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, evidence is piling up of alleged atrocities perpetrated by the Russian army in Ukraine. Both world leaders and the International Criminal Court have dubbed these war crimes. And in an address to the UN this week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky went further and accused Russia of genocide. So what does it actually mean to break the laws of war? And how do you prove it? And what does accountability look like? To help answer these questions, I spoke with Stephen Rapp. He was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes Issues from 2009 to 2015. And prosecuted war crimes committed in Rwanda and Sierra Leone. He joined me to offer his perspective on what happens next in the path to justice. Ambassador Rapp, if you would begin with giving us a definition of war crime. What is a war crime?
Well, they're violations of rules of war that have come down to us really from the 16th century and were particularly put into effect by President Lincoln during the Civil War and by Geneva Conventions that were started being negotiated actually in 1863 and generally involve minimizing harm to civilians and to civilian objects and humanitarian facilities, ways in which war can be fought. War is, of course, horrendous and damage and death will occur, but so that it doesn't kill so many people. And it was all developed after some of the battles of the 19th century in which wounded were left in the field to die and which the towns were destroyed and nothing was done to protect them. And frankly, from a military strategy point of view, they make a lot of sense. Now, we do have sort of two types. One has to do with kind of the conflict of hostilities. You know, when you engage in bombing or artillery or tank fire, you need to intentionally attack a military target. And if it can be shown that you are intentionally attacking a civilian target, that is a war crime. If, on the other hand, you are indiscriminate and you don't discriminate between civilian and military, you say, they're all bad over there. They could have surrendered a while ago. Even the children will go up and shoot us. And you just attack the whole area indiscriminately without really any knowledge of where the enemy may be. Those are indiscriminate attacks and those are war crimes. And then of course, sometimes you have a particularly tough target that you need to take out. And then the question is, what kind of force can you use? Recognizing that naturally, if you use a lot of force, it will have so-called collateral damage. And that becomes an even more subjective thing where you're using sometimes a substantial amount of force and there's a lot of collateral damage, but the military gain is so insignificant. I think, for instance, of the use of artillery on Chernobyl earlier, because it had such an enormous risk of harm really to the whole continent. For whatever minor gain there might have been militarily, and indeed going after civilian power infrastructure is not a military target, to be frank. So it wasn't even a military target to begin with. So that kind of thing can be a war crime. Those are in conflict of hostilities. Then there are the other ones and these are the things we've seen in Bucha. And sometimes these are done by irregular units or militia or others in which there's some deniability. But these are things that are done really to intimidate and subjugate the population. But the idea that you kill people in the street, commit the summary executions, take hostages, they shoot one, you shoot 100, you do all of these horrible things against the civilian populations. And it can get into issues, of course, of torture to get information, but also just torture to humiliate and destroy and to subjugate and to put people in fear. And then obviously we have the ways in which rape is used as a weapon of war. And these kind of acts are almost always crimes. But the challenge to them is extending the liability beyond the individual perpetrator up the chain of command, because there's always some deniability at the higher level. These are rogue elements, et cetera.
So in your view, are war crimes being committed by Russia in Ukraine?
Well, certainly in my view as a prosecutor, if I were putting together a case today, now understand still up to a judge or jury, whatever the trier of fact is, to determine whether I've proven my case beyond a reasonable doubt. But the way in which the hostilities are being conducted, particularly in places like Mariupol, this bombardment, this sort of scorched earth sort of approach, following what were called the Grozny rules, which is the opposite of rules, which are rules reflecting what Russia did in 1999 as Vladimir Putin was coming into power, to just completely destroy and flatten Grozny. That kind of way of fighting is ipso facto a war crime. And then when you have what's happening there, civilians are being denied food and medicine. And to actually cut people off from food and medicine in that situation is the war crime of starvation, quite specifically. And so that kind of battle scene, which is being conducted day by day by day under Russian general command, goes right up to the top. That's not renegade forces that are doing that. And then certainly the kind of thing we're seeing in Bucha, old women being shot down in their gardens, people shot off bicycles, the torture places with corpses, the hundreds of corpses that are now being discovered, and the ways in which their hands are bound, shot in the back of the head. I mean, you can't do that to a terrorist. There is a requirement that you have to go through a judicial process before you can execute someone, which sometimes is legal under international law. So those are almost all war crimes, but attributing them to the high command is challenging. Do keep in mind that we do have in international law the idea of command responsibility. And if those people are under your command, if those are regular soldiers of the Russian army, and I think the pictures and everything that were taken by the citizens show that, then the top is responsible if they fail to take action to prevent or to punish it. And this sort of total denying that, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes kind of approach the Russians take, actually weakens their case.
So we now have international leaders like President of Ukraine himself calling President Putin a war criminal. We have French President Macron use the term war crimes. The U.S. has already formally determined that members of Russia's forces were committing war crimes in Ukraine. Who has the power now to investigate this?
First of all, these are crimes being committed on the territory of Ukraine. And so Ukrainian authorities, the prosecutor general has authority to prosecute them. And they have laws. They've incorporated the Geneva Convention in their laws. And they can prosecute these people for a variety of war crimes if they can get their hands on them. And they're very active in that
but
effort.
Isn't that the point? How can they possibly prosecute when they can't get their hands on them?
That's always a challenge in international justice and enforcement of international law, even by national institutions. Do keep in mind that they will get their hands on some of them. This is a battlefield in which Russians are being surrounded, in which wounded people may be left behind, in which a lot of the soldiers themselves are conscripts and unwilling to do what they're doing and may be willing to describe information about operations. And it will be possible for the Ukrainians to develop some cases against individuals that they detain. Now, of course, if they detain people, they're prisoners of war, they treat them humanely, they don't have to answer questions, but they quite often do. And if they gain that information, you can develop a few of these cases, a colonel here, a major there, et cetera, that may be found on the field of battle. They can also charge other individuals. They cannot, as one state, prosecute the leader or some of the top leadership of another under international law. That takes an international tribunal. But certainly they can be building these cases. Now, of course, they spent a lot of time trying to build cases in the Donbass. And I've worked with them in the past and dealt with some of the civil society organizations that were able to get in and collect information. They haven't had success there because they couldn't collar those guys. They were over in Russia or they were over on the other side of the front in the Donbass. But here, given the battlefield, I think there's going to be more possibilities to get started. Hopefully in the long run, it'll be possible to build cases against quite a lot of perpetrators and maybe eventually bring them to justice. I mean, we have 95-year-old Auschwitz camp guards on trial, et cetera. You know, it can take a long time. Message needs to be, if you commit these crimes, you know, someday you may be collared.
And when does the International Criminal Court step in?
Well, the International Criminal Court has stepped in already. Do keep in mind the International Criminal Court is a court that only does cases that states can't or don't have the capacity or will to. Now, here there's plenty of will on the part of the Ukrainians, but their capacity, and there can be legal impediments. Sometimes the international law is better for going after high-level command. Legal doctrines have been developed that allow us to do that. So there are some advantages going after the top people to the International Criminal Court. It is involved because Ukraine in 2014 gave jurisdiction to the ICC for these crimes that met the international level of gravity. Now, the prosecutor would have had to go get a motion from the judges to approve going in, or a state referring it in. Ukraine was not yet a state in the ICC, a party, but 41 states in the ICC have sent it in. So the prosecutor is on the job and can develop a case right up to Putin and put out an international arrest warrant for him. People say, what's the point of that? Well, obviously, you know, the International Tribunal put out an arrest warrant for Milosevic when he was in power in Serbia, and people thought that was crazy. 15 months later, he couldn't steal enough votes to stay in power. 25 months later, he was on a helicopter to The Hague. I prosecuted Charles Taylor, president of Liberia, the next country over from Sierra Leone where these crimes had been committed. Didn't appear anybody was going to be able to get him. He was finally forced into exile, and eventually, with a lot of diplomatic pressure and initiative, 3 years later, we had him in custody. Quite often, the key is the country itself that's holding the individual, that has the individual, may have diplomatic pressures, may have economic pressures, may have sanctions, may have restrictions, or the things that they want to get off. And if you're really tough about conditioning compliance, you can sometimes get these cases. Of course, obviously, if somebody's in power and they're all in and no one dares touch them, you know, they can go to their grave like Stalin without holding any accountability, but they'll have an arrest warrant over their head.
So considering the fact that Ukraine's army is itself involved in this war, how is Ukraine collecting any evidence? Where is the evidence being collected, and how? By whom?
Well, I mean, the Ukrainian prosecutor general is basically, has a structure of police, judicial police, and ordinary police that can respond to investigative requests. And so they talk about thousands of those sort of officers that can now be deployed to do various tasks at these crime scenes. Now, obviously, these are war zones. Some of those officers fled with their families. There are also people at the top in that prosecutor office that understand international crimes and the kind of things you need for proof. And that can be complicated. But certainly when it comes to doing crime scenes and taking a picture of whatever is there and bagging and tagging it and getting the pocket trash out of the deceased Russian soldiers, finding if you see a phone, picking up everything that you have and then working with particularly international technical assistance to exploit that material, you know, that's important. I think we still are in a situation where there's a real absence of capacity to build the evidence according to the levels that we want. There's a tendency always, and we see it in the press, of course, that one focuses on the extent one can without horrifying people on the scenes of death and destruction. Whereas, you know, we're always telling observers, you know, turn your camera 360. We want to see what evidence there is of where they came from in the picture, almost more than we need to see the gory details. Because the key always is, how do we connect this to people who we might be able to charge and particularly to bring it to justice?
I wonder whether you have been involved in investigating any of these possible war crimes in Ukraine.
Well, I'm involved in about a dozen different organizations, and I think three are specifically involved on the ground, and I've been advising and working with them in terms of how to do that. One of those organizations may soon be deployed on this linkage mission, which is so important. There are things that we've learned in other places that are kind of new. often present challenges, that you really do need the best possible battlefield collection of evidence. And if you're a soldier fighting in a war, you're not going to stop and pick up the evidence. But there are things that can be done more effectively on the battlefield, connecting that back to the civilian authorities that are doing the prosecution, some opportunities that are missed, particularly on this challenge. It's where international justice has either succeeded or failed. And there have been some cases in the ICC, high-level cases, Kenya, Ivory Coast, Central African Republic, that have failed. Not because there weren't thousands of people killed and murdered, raped, whatever, but they couldn't prove the connection. Making sure that we can prove that connection is, in the end, the most essential thing. And a lot of that connection evidence is available early and not late.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Ambassador Stephen Rapp.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Stephen Rapp. He's former ambassador at large for war crimes issues and distinguished fellow at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's Center for Prevention of Genocide. Now, speaking of connections, much of what we're seeing in terms of atrocities going on in Ukraine, we saw in Syria, and in part, those were perpetrated by Russia itself. And they seem to be following largely the same patterns of destruction in Ukraine that we saw back in Syria. What do you make of that?
Well, I certainly agree with your observation, Diane, particularly when we talk about places like Mariupol. Mark Twain famously said, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. And here, it almost more than rhymes when you have situations like Aleppo, eastern Aleppo, with Russian bombing from the sky and others on the ground committing horrible acts. They essentially destroyed the eastern half, the older half of one of the most historic cities in the world, in order to get the message that you cannot beat Assad, you cannot win, you can have no hope, bombed every hospital. And we even have ways in which it was possible to triangulate people on the ground, seeing the plane overhead, the hospital that was actually buried underground, and then the bomb hitting right on top of the hospital, yes, and the radio of the Russian pilot cheering the fact that he got a direct hit on his target, which would be an open field other than the fact there was a hospital underneath it. And they knew it. And so you actually see the Russians there committing a war crime attack on hospitals, no military significance at all. Indeed, it was part of the doctrine of the Russians that violation of the Geneva Conventions of 1863 is, sort of the first thing you violate. Hospitals, allow people to recover and continue to live, allow soldiers to be patched up. And by the way, just because a hospital is patching up enemy soldiers, doesn't mean that it's not a humanitarian thing. I mean, that's the first principle. But they attack that in order to make life unlivable in these areas. And so they're doing the same thing. They're doing it now in Ukraine and other countries.
That brings me to the question of genocide and whether that word is particularly important when it comes to bringing any kind of prosecution against violators. What constitutes genocide? What is the legal definition of genocide?
Genocide is often an emotive term used when there's mass killing, and it does have a rather specific legal definition. And one always hates to come along with some people who are suffering and saying, well, not quite a genocide. You feel like you're dismissing them. But of course, it's important to realize that this is a crime that has been established under international law, a convention which is applicable across the world. But it requires an intent to destroy an ethnic, religious, or national group in whole or really substantial part. In Rwanda, where I prosecuted, every case was a genocide. There's no question they were seeking to destroy this Tutsi ethnic group. In the former Yugoslavia, where you had ethnic cleansing, rape and torture and detention and killing and horrendous crimes, destroying the homes and the livelihood of particularly Bosnian Muslims, in those situations, that was viewed as sort of ethnic cleansing, which was to push them out of an area and create a pure area for the Serb population. The judges said, no, that's not genocide. Just killing a bunch in order to get them to move, that's not genocide. You have to have this intent to destroy. And now it doesn't mean you have to kill a lot necessarily, but you have to prove the intent. But how do you prove the intent without a Bossy conference agreement for the final solution? It is challenging. I was yesterday on a platform with the executive director of the Ukrainian American Congress, and he was pointing out some things that were consistent with genocidal intent. Some of the language and propaganda we're seeing out there about Ukraine doesn't exist. We heard it from Putin. We're hearing about taking this nation apart, etc. And so if you begin to see this idea of sort of destroying the Ukrainian people. I'm not just taking them off the map, but sort of creating a situation where they're going to either be Russians or dead. Then I think you might get there. And there certainly is the danger of genocide. And so there's an obligation for the parties to do everything to prevent it. But I don't think we're there yet. These terms, of course, are very powerful, as we know. Putin himself going in. Said he was doing it to prevent a genocide. And of course, Ukraine went to international court and said there ain't no genocide, there ain't no right to intervene on the basis of this.
What about the Russian use of the word denazification?
Well, obviously, denazification in and of itself isn't genocide, though it's part of the rhetoric. In Rwanda, when you begin to call your opponents the other group, bugs, cockroaches. You know, what do you do with cockroaches? You stomp on them, and you don't want any of them. You want them gone. And so, when you begin to have this term like denazification, now obviously we have far right groups there. There is an Azov regiment. There are some groups that are sympathetic to the period in the 40s when they allied with the Nazis against Soviet Russia, and so there is a little bit of that kernel there. But that's not—it's not growing. The polls, less than 2% of people adhere to it. Having a Jewish president who once very much joined Europe is actually quite the opposite of what sort of fear that you might have. You'd have more fear in Hungary, to be frank, or in some of the places that Putin supports of Nazification than you would hear. So it really is a ludicrous thing. But you are, I think, putting your idea on it. When you start calling somebody a Nazi, it's like to say you are a monster, and we need to get rid of monsters. And so there is a little bit of that that I think people can make those arguments. I would point out it's important under our American law right now. Our war crime statute that we have, which Senator Durbin's pressing a bill introduced yesterday, I hope it'll have bipartisan support. We got a hole in our war crime statute. If one of these perps comes to the U.S. or some oligarch who's paying for the killers is in the U.S., we can't prosecute them for war crimes unless there's an American victim. It's a hole in our law. They torture somebody, we can prosecute them. If they commit a war crime, we can't. Uh-huh. And we do have a genocide law, but we don't have a crimes against humanity law. And of course, crimes against humanity are crimes against the civilian population and violence in the civilian population, even on a political basis. And the crime of persecution on a political basis, for instance. These would be very useful to have, and every other country has it, and we don't.
You'll forgive me for saying this, but these words seem almost meaningless when we see the devastation that's taking place. And though the term genocide is a legal one, if in fact that word takes hold in what is happening in Ukraine yet, would there be more assistance going to Ukraine than there is now?
Probably not. Situations in the past, genocides committed, and people even like Rwanda didn't want to put their own people in harm's way, and rescue missions were sent in to save the foreigners, but not the Rwandans. And so, I don't anticipate boots on the ground from Western countries or no-fly zones, et cetera, still because of the concern about Russia. There'd be a possibility of taking a genocide case to the International Court of Justice, Ukraine against Russia, getting a determination that it is genocide, but that can't be enforced except by a vote of the UN Security Council, which, of course, would be vetoed by Russia. So, it would give another charge on the menu for prosecutors, and it's one that they could attempt, and if they didn't win, it could win on the war crimes or crimes against humanity basis, so those kind of things. But and it would create this obligation for everybody, ergo omnes, the whole world needs to take some action to prevent it, but how much concrete action beyond what's being done already, which is quite significant, I think is probably couldn't be greater than it is already.
So I would ask you the same question that President Zelensky put before the United Nations. If the UN can't do something here, what good is it? What is the UN for? What is it doing? What can it do?
Many of us are disappointed with the UN, but it turns out it's not the fault of the building. It's not the fault of the people that work for it. It's the fault of the states and the charter, which essentially gives Russia the ability to stop anything that they don't want, and China as well. And so the UN can perform some useful things in places of the world where they don't have a dog in the fight. Even there, the Russians are often opposing it or wanting to move in the Wagner Group or do something else. So they used to be okay on situations in Africa, and now they're not. So you have those real issues, and then you're dealing with humanitarian and other kinds of things that the UN can do and are important, and obviously a forum to hear the debate. A great speech by Zelensky and the ludicrous denial by the Russians. So it is that forum, but we have to go other places. The ICC doesn't require for Russia to say yes, because these crimes are on the territory of Ukraine and they've accepted jurisdiction. And it doesn't require us to do action in the international banking system and in a whole lot of areas. We don't need the United Nations, and even to prosecute the Ukrainians, of course, at the national level don't need it, and other European countries and ourselves that might gain jurisdiction over a case, we don't need it. So like I've had to deal with in Syria, where the Russians blocked any kind of accountability, we have found ways to get into European courts to prosecute some perpetrators. We've got to find a workaround.
Like what? What kind of workaround?
Well, I mean, by workaround, I'm saying the ICC, in a way, is a workaround. It's a workaround the UN. It's an international institution that doesn't require Russia's approval.
Right. Right.
That's what we need now. In the end, how do we get anybody in custody? Putin's favorite arms dealer, Viktor Bout, we got him out on it, pretending that we had an arms deal for him in Bangkok, and we grabbed him and he got him 25 years. So, it's possible to sometimes get these people. So, we've got to raise the risks. But obviously, more important, I mean, I'm the person of law, not of kinetic action, of judges and lawyers and prosecutors and police who are well trained in following the law and international human rights and everything else. That can be effective, but at the moment, it's essential that Ukraine have the arms that it needs to defend itself, not to lose this war, and that's really important, and that they comply with the laws of war, because any international prosecutor, you have to look at both sides, and there will certainly be situations where a bunch of Russian prisoners are killed or mistreated, those won't be the kind of war crimes that are from the top. They may be a renegade, and emotional and have some mitigation. But the point is, you've got to hold everybody to the same standard.
So from your perspective, what more can the U.S. do now?
Yeah, keep in mind, we're not in the ICC. We've had a tough relationship with it ourselves, and we've said it doesn't apply to us, even if we commit a crime on a state party's territory, and that position was a wrong one. We need to say that, because otherwise Russia's not responsible either. And we've got to get ourselves right on these issues. And we need to assist the ICC. We can do it under our law. During the Obama administration, when I was ambassador at large, we assisted with two of the major fugitives who surrendered to us, and we took them to the ICC. We can provide investigative forces and technical support as our European allies are. The prosecutor has only 71 investigators for like 15 country situations. We really need to get in there and clearly assist that effort. I think we could also work with like former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who wants to establish a tribunal, and we haven't talked about this, for the crime of aggression. ICC doesn't have jurisdiction. Aggression was sort of the central crime here, death raining from the sky suddenly on a peaceful Ukraine that hadn't, nobody done anything to Russia in 8 years. And suddenly you had this just absolutely unprovoked attack. There could be a court established by Ukraine and a partnership of states to pursue that as well. And then we need to get our own laws right. As I said earlier, Attorney General yesterday spoke to us, meeting with Eurojust and Europol, and the United States participates in those meetings. We go to these meetings, and all these countries have all the laws on the books to prosecute, and we've got loopholes in all over the place, and don't even have a Crimes Against Humanity statute. If we're going to be a partner in these efforts, we need to at least have our law reflect the law that we impose when we join international tribunals or when we prosecute people at Guantanamo. So this is these are all things that need to be done. You just don't go to meetings or call people war criminals. You have to put your money and your legal tools and your aid and assistance where your mouth is.
So what is going to happen if we cannot bring accountability to bear here? What's going to prevent other nations from following Russia's lead?
Well, that's the real danger of it. I thought in the first 15 years or so after the end of the Cold War, we were actually able to do some very positive things in international justice. And we began to raise the risk on people who might commit crimes like this. And certainly since Syria and the way in which justice has been blocked there, the message, and it's been understood by the military in Myanmar and running a coup d'etat against Aung San Suu Kyi, has seen it in Sudan as well. Shoot demonstrators, people, children down in the street, and who cares? We've already sent that signal. This would send that signal even stronger, that impunity reigns, and that you can get away with mass murder. And so if we don't take a very tough legal stance here and go all in terms of our legal tools and our cooperation with committed allies, none of us are going to be safe in the future.
Ambassador Rapp, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Rapp, former ambassador at large for war crimes issues and distinguished fellow at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's Center for Prevention of Genocide. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.